But how the breach in the wall was really made?
Magic, perhaps? I am afraid not, Archlector.
That is unfortunate. Some proof of how this particular trick was managed might be of use to us. Still, and Salt sighed as though he had expected no better, one cannot have everything. Did you speak to these people?
I did. Baez, if I may use the name, is a most slippery talker. Without the aid of anything more persuasive than the questions themselves, I could get nothing from him. His friend, the Northman, also bears some study. One crease formed across Salt's smooth forehead.
You suspect some connection with this savage Bethod?
Possibly.
Possibly,
echoed the Archlector sourly, as though the very word was poison.
What else?
There has been a new addition to the Merry Band.
I know. The Navigator.
Why do I even bother? Yes, Your Eminence, a Navigator.
Good luck to them. Those penny-pinching fortune-tellers are always more trouble than they're worth, blubbering on about God and what have you. Greedy savages.
Absolutely. More trouble than they're worth, Archlector, though it would be interesting to know why they have employed one.
And why have they?
Glockter paused for a moment. I don't know.
Huh! Snorted Salt. What else?
Following their nighttime visitation, our friends were relocated to a suite of rooms beside the park. There was a most grisly death a few nights ago, not 20 paces from their windows.
Superior Goyle mentioned this. He said it was nothing to concern myself about, that there was no connection with our visitors. I left the matter in his hands.
He frowned at Glockter.
Did I make the wrong decision?
Oh, dear me, I need not think too long over this one. Absolutely not, Archlector. Glockter bowed his head in deep respect. If the superior is satisfied, then so am I.
So, what you're telling me is that, all in all, we have nothing.
Not quite nothing. There is this. Glockter fished the ancient scroll from his coat pocket and held it out. Salt had a look of mild curiosity on his face as he took it and unrolled it on the table, stared down at the meaningless symbols.
What is it?
Ha! So you don't know everything. I suppose you could say that it's a piece of history, an account of how Baez defeated the Mastermaker.
A piece of history?
Salt tapped his finger thoughtfully on the tabletop.
And how does it help us?
How does it help you, you mean? According to this, it was our friend Baez who sealed up the House of the Maker. Glockter nodded towards the looming shape beyond the window. Sealed it up and took the key.
Key? That tower has always been sealed. Always. As far as I'm aware, there's not even a keyhole.
Those were precisely my thoughts, Your Eminence. Slowly, Salt began to smile.
Stories are all in how you tell them, eh? Our friend Baez knows that well enough, I dare say. He would use our own stories against us, but now we switch cups with him. I enjoy the irony.
He picked up the scroll again.
Is it authentic?
Does it matter?
Of course not.
Salt rose gracefully from his chair and paced slowly over to the window, tapping the rolled-up scroll against his fingers. He stood there for some time, staring out. When he turned, he had developed a look of the deepest self-satisfaction.
It occurs to me that there will be a feast tomorrow evening, a celebration for our new champion swordsman, Captain Luthar.
That cheating little worm.
The great and the good will be in attendance. The queen, both princes, most of the closed council, several leading noblemen.
Not forgetting the king himself. It has come to something when his presence at dinner is not even worth mentioning.
That would be the ideal audience for our little unmasking, don't you think?
Glockter cautiously bowed his head. "Of course, Archlector, the ideal audience. Providing it works, it might be an embarrassing audience to fail in front of." But Salt was already anticipating his triumph.
"The perfect gathering, and just enough time to make the necessary arrangements. Send a messenger to our friend the First of the Magi, and let him know that he and his companions are cordially invited to a dinner tomorrow evening. I trust that you will attend yourself."
"Me?" Glockter bowed again. "I would not miss it for anything, Your Eminence."
"Good. Bring your practicals with you. Our friends might become violent when they realize the game is up. Barbarians of this sort, who can tell what they might be capable of?"
A barely perceptible motion of the Archlector's gloved hand indicated that the interview was finished. "All those stairs just for this?" Salt was looking down his nose at the scroll as Glockter finally reached the threshold.
"The ideal audience,"
he was muttering as the heavy doors clicked shut. In the north, a chieftain's own carles ate with him every night in his hall. The women brought the food in wooden bowls. You'd stab the lumps of meat out with a knife, and with a knife you'd cut them up, then you'd stuff the bits in your mouth with your fingers. If you found some bone or gristle, you'd toss it down on the straw for the dogs. The table, if there was one, was a few slabs of ill-fitting wood, stained and gouged and scarred from having knives stuck in it. The carles sat on long benches, with maybe a chair or two for the named men. It'd be dark, especially in the long winters, and smoky from the fire pit and the chagger pipes. There'd often be singing of songs, usually shouting of good-natured insults, sometimes screaming of bad-natured ones, and always a lot of drink. The only rule was that you waited for the chief to begin. Logan had no idea what the rules might be here, but he guessed there were a lot. The guests were sat round three long tables set out in a horseshoe, 60 people or more. Everyone had their own chair, and the dark wood of the tabletops was polished to a high sheen, made bright enough for Logan to see the blurry outline of his face in, by hundreds of candles scattered round the walls and down the tables. Every guest had at least three blunt knives, and several other things scattered about in front of them that Logan had no idea of the use for, including a big flat circle of shiny metal. There was no shouting, and certainly no singing, just a low murmur, like a beehive, as people muttered between themselves, leaning towards each other as if they were swapping secrets. The clothes were stranger than ever. Old men wore heavy robes of black, red, and gold, trimmed with shining fur, even in the heat. Young men wore tight-fitting jackets in bright crimson, green, or blue, festooned with ropes and knots of gold and silver thread. Women were hung with chains and rings of glittering gold and flashing jewels, wearing strange dresses of vivid cloth that were ridiculously loose and billowing in places, painfully tight in others, and left others still entirely distractingly bare. Even the servants were dressed like lords, prowling around behind the tables, leaning forward silently to fill goblets with sweet, thin wine. Logan had already drunk a deal of it, and the bright room had taken on a pleasant glow. The problem was the lack of food. He hadn't eaten since that morning, and his stomach was growling. He'd been eyeing the jars of plants sat on the tables before the guests. They had bright flowers on them, and didn't look much like food to him, but then they ate some strange things in this country. There was nothing for it but to try. He snatched one of the things from the jar, a long piece of green plant with a yellow flower on the end. He took a nibble from the bottom of the stem. Tasteless and watery, but at least it was crunchy. He took a larger bite and munched on it without relish.
"I don't think they're meant for eating."
Logan glanced round, surprised to hear the northern tongue spoken here, surprised that anyone was speaking to him at all. His neighbour, a tall, gaunt man with a sharp, lined face, was leaning towards him with an embarrassed smile. Logan recognized him vaguely. He'd been at the sword game, holding the blades for the lad from the gate.
"Ah,"
mumbled Logan round his mouthful of plant. The taste of the stuff got worse with time.
"Sorry,"
he said, once he had forced it down his throat. "I don't know much about these things."
"Honestly, neither do I. How did it taste?"
"Like shit." Logan held the half-eaten flower uncertainly in his fingers. The tiled floor was spotlessly clean. It hardly seemed right to toss the thing under the table. There were no dogs anyway, and even if there had been, he doubted they'd have eaten the thing. A dog would have more sense than him. He dropped it on the metal platter and wiped his fingers on his chest, hoping that no one had noticed.
"My name is West," said the man, offering his hand. "I come from Angland."
Logan gave the hand a squeeze.
"Nine Fingers, a Bryn from way up north of the high places."
"Nine Fingers?" Logan waggled his stump at him, and the man nodded.
"Ah, I see."
He smiled, as though remembering something funny.
"I heard a song once in Angland about a nine-fingered man.
What was he called now?"
"The Bloody Nine, that was it."
Logan felt his grin slipping.
"One of those northern songs, you know the kind, all violence. He cut off heads by the cartload, this Bloody Nine, and burned towns, and mixed blood with his beer and whatnot. That wasn't you, was it?"
The man was making a joke. Logan laughed nervously.
"No, no, I never heard of him." But luckily West had already moved on.
"Tell me, you look like you've seen some battles in your time."
"I've been in some scrapes."
It was pointless to deny it.
"Do you know of this one they call the King of the Northmen, this man Bethod?"
Logan glanced sideways.
"I know of him."
"You fought against him in the wars?"
Logan grimaced. The sour taste of the plant seemed to be lingering in his mouth. He picked up his goblet and took a swallow.
"Worse," he said slowly as he set it down. "I fought for him."
This only seemed to make the man more curious than ever.
"Then you know about his tactics and his troops, his way of making war?"
Logan nodded.
"What can you tell me about him?"
"That he's a most cunning and ruthless opponent, with no pity or scruple in him. Make no mistake, I hate the man. But there's been no war leader in his league since the days of Scarling Hoodless. He has that in him which men respect, or fear, or at least obey. He pushes his men hard, so he can make the field first and choose his own ground. But they march hard for him because he brings them victories. He's cautious when he must be, and fearless when he must be, but neglects no detail. He delights in every trick of war, in setting traps and ambushes, in mounting feints and deceptions, in sending sudden raids against the unwary. Look for him where you expect him least, and expect him to be strongest where he seems the weakest. Beware him most of all when he seems to run. Most men fear him, and those that don't are fools."
Logan picked up the flower from the plate and started snapping it into pieces. "His armies are grouped about the chieftains of the clans, some of them strong war leaders in their own right. Most of his fighters are thralls, peasants pressed into service, lightly armed with spear or bow, fast-moving in loose groups. In the past, they were ill-trained and taken from their farms for only a short time. But the wars have been raging for so long that many of them have become hard fighters and show scant mercy." He began to arrange the bits of plant, imagining they were groups of men and the plate a hill. "Each chieftain keeps carles besides his own household warriors, well-armed and armoured, skilled with axe and sword and spear, well-disciplined. Some few have horses, but Bethod will keep those out of sight, waiting for the best moment to charge or pursue." He pulled the yellow petals from the flower, and they became horsemen, hidden on the flanks. "Last, there are the known men, the named men, those warriors who've earned great respect in battle. They might lead groups of carles on the field, or act as scouts or raiders, sometimes far in the enemy's rear." He realized the plate was covered with a mess of broken pieces of plant and brushed them hurriedly off onto the table. That's the tradition of war in the north, but Bethod's always had a fancy for new ideas. He's read books and studied other ways of fighting, and often talked of buying flat bows and heavy armor and strong war horses from the southern traders, and of making an army to be feared throughout the world. Logan became aware he had been talking solidly for ages. He hadn't said half that many words together in years, but West was staring at him with a look of rapt attention.
"You speak like a man who knows his business."
"Well, you've happened upon the one subject on which I might be reckoned an expert. What advice would you give to a man who had to fight a war against Bethod?"
Logan frowned.
"Be careful, and watch your back." Giselle was not enjoying himself. At first, of course, it had seemed a delightful idea, just the thing he had always dreamed of, a celebration in his honor, attended by so many of the Union's greatest. Surely it was only the start of his wonderful new life as a champion of the contest. The great things which everyone had predicted, no, promised for him, were almost arrived, poised like overripe fruit to drop from the tree and into his lap. Promotions and glory were sure to follow close behind. Perhaps they would make him major tonight, and he would go to the war in Angland as commander of a full battalion. But, strangely, it appeared that most of the guests were more interested in their own affairs. They chatted to each other about government matters, about the business of merchant houses, about issues of land and title and politics. Fencing, and his remarkable skill at it, were scarcely mentioned. No immediate promotion had been forthcoming. He simply had to sit there and smile and accept the odd lukewarm congratulation from strangers in splendid clothes who barely even looked him in the eye. A wax effigy could have done the same job. He had to admit the adulation of the commoners in the arena had been considerably more gratifying. At least they had sounded as if they meant it. Still, he had never before been within the palace compound, a fortress within the fortress of the Agriont, where few indeed were permitted to tread. Now he was seated at the top table in the king's own dining hall, though Giselle did not doubt that His Majesty took the majority of his meals propped up in bed, and most likely had them fed to him with a spoon. There was a stage set into the wall at the far end of the room. Giselle had once heard that Ostus, the child king, had jesters perform for him at every meal. Morlick the Mad, by contrast, had staged executions there to go with his dinner. King Casimir, it was said, had likenesses of his worst enemies shout insults at him from that stage, while he took his breakfast every morning, to keep his hatred for them fresh. The curtains were closed now, though. Giselle would have to look for his entertainment elsewhere, and in this regard the pickings were slim indeed. Marshal Verus prattled on in his ear. He, at least, was still interested in fencing. Unfortunately, he talked of nothing else.
"I never saw such a thing. The whole city is buzzing with it. Most remarkable bout that anyone's ever seen. I swear, you're better even than San Danglocter used to be, and I never thought to see his like again. I never dreamed you had it in you to fight like that, Giselle. Never had the slightest inkling."
"Hmm," said Giselle. The Crown Prince Ladislaw and his bride-to-be, Therese of Tallinns, made a dazzling couple at the top of the table, just beside the dozing king. They were oblivious to all that was going on around them, but hardly in the way that one might hope for from two young lovers. They were arguing viciously in scarcely hushed voices, while their neighbours studiously pretended not to suck in every word.
"Well, I'll be going to war soon in Angland, so you need not suffer me too much longer," whined Ladislaw. "I might be killed. Perhaps that would make your highness happy."
"Pray, don't die on my account," returned Therese, her Styrian accent dripping venom. "But if you must, you must. I suppose I will learn to bear the sorrow."
Somebody nearer at hand distracted Giselle by thumping on the table.
"Damn these commoners!
damn peasantry's up in arms in Starakland. Lazy dogs, they refuse to work a stroke.
It's these taxes, grumbled the man's neighbour. These war taxes have them all stirred up. Have you heard about this damn character they call the Tanner? Some bloody peasant preaching revolution. Open as you please. I heard that one of the king's collectors was set on by a mob, not a mile outside the walls of Kelm. One of the king's collectors, I say. By a mob, not a mile outside the city walls.
We've damn well brought it on ourselves.
The speaker's face was out of sight, but Giselle recognized him by the gold-embroidered cuffs on his gown. Morovia, the High Justice.
Treat a man like a dog, and sooner or later he'll bite you. It's a simple fact. Our role as governors and as noblemen is surely to respect and protect the common man, rather than to oppress and scorn him.
I wasn't talking about scorn, Lord Morovia, or oppression, just about them paying what's due to us as their landlords, and for that matter, their natural betters.
Marshal Verus, meanwhile, had not let up for an instant.
It was quite a thing, eh? The way you put him down, one steel against two.
The old soldier swished his hand around in the air.
The whole town's buzzing. You're bound for great things now, my boy. Mark my words. Bound for great things. I'll be damned if you don't have my seat on the closed council one day.
It really was too much. Giselle had put up with the man for all those months. He had somehow imagined that if he won, that would be the end of it. But it seemed he would be disappointed in this as in so much else. It was strange, but Giselle had never fully realized before what a boring old imbecile the Lord Marshal was. He was realizing now, though, and no mistake. To further add to his dismay, there were several people seated about the tables who would most definitely not have been among his chosen guests. He supposed he could make a dispensation for Salt, the arch-lector of the Inquisition, since he sat on the closed council and was without doubt a powerful figure. But Giselle could not comprehend why he might have brought that bastard Glockter with him. The cripple looked even more ill than usual, twitching eyes sunken in dark circles. For some reason he was occasionally shooting grim and suspicious glances at Giselle, as though he suspected him of some crime or other. It was a damn cheek, what with it being his feast and all. Even worse, on the other side of the room, was that old bald man, the one who had called himself Baez. Giselle had still not got to the bottom of his strange words of congratulation at the contest, or his father's reaction to the man, for that matter. And he had his hideous friend, the nine-fingered barbarian, beside him. Major West had the misfortune of being seated next to the primitive, but he was making the best of it. Indeed, the two were engaged in a lively conversation. The Northman broke into sudden peals of laughter and thumped the table with his big fist, making the glasses rattle. At least they were enjoying themselves at his party, Giselle thought sourly, but he almost wished he was down there with them. Still, he knew that he wanted to be a big, important man some day, to wear things with a lot of fur and a heavy golden chain of office, to have people bow and scrape and fawn before him. He had made that decision long ago, and he supposed he still liked the idea. It was just that, up close, the whole thing seemed so awfully false and boring. He would much, much rather have been on his own with Ardy, even though he had seen her the night before. There was nothing boring about her.
"The savages are closing on Ostenholm, that's what I heard," someone shouted over on Giselle's left. "The Lord Governor Mead, he's raising an army and has sworn to turn them out of Angland."
"Mead, that swollen-headed old fool, couldn't turn a pie out of a dish.
Enough to beat these northern animals, though, what? One good Union man's worth 10 of their kind."
Giselle heard Teresa's voice cutting suddenly shrill above the hubbub, almost loud enough to be heard at the far end of the room.
"Of course, I will marry where my father commands me, but I don't have to like it."
She appeared so vicious at that moment that he would not have been surprised to see her stab the crown prince in the face with her fork. Giselle felt somewhat gratified to see that he was not the only one who had trouble with women. Oh, yes, a remarkable performance. Everyone's talking about it.
Baruz was still droning. Giselle squirmed in his chair. How long was this bloody business going to take? He felt suffocated. He glanced across the faces again and caught Glockter's eye, staring at him with that grim, suspicious look on his wasted face. Giselle still couldn't meet that gaze for long, his party or no. What the hell did the cripple have against him anyhow?
The little bastard. He cheated. Somehow I know it.
Glockter's eyes tracked slowly across the table opposite until they lighted on Baez. The old fraud was sitting there quite at home.
And he had some part in it. They cheated together, somehow.
My lords and ladies!
The chatter faded as the Lord Chamberlain rose to address the room.
I would like to welcome you all on His Majesty's behalf to this humble gathering.
The king himself stirred briefly, gazed vacantly about him, blinked, then closed his eyes.
We are gathered, of course, in honor of Captain Giselle Danlusa, who has recently added his name to that most select roll of honor, those swordsmen who have been victorious at the summer contest.
A few glasses were raised, and there were some half-hearted mumblings of agreement.
I recognize several other winners among the assembly here today, many of them now the holders of high office. Lord Marshal Veruz, Commander Valdis of the Knights Herald, Major West down there, now on Marshal Burr's staff, of course. Even I was a winner in my day.
He smiled and looked down at his bulging paunch. Though my day was some time ago, of course. A polite ripple of laughter passed round the room.
I notice that I don't get a mention. Not all winners are enviable, eh?
Victors at the contest, continued the Lord Chamberlain, have so often gone on to great things. I hope, and indeed we all hope, that it may prove so for our young friend Captain Luther.
I hope he meets a slow death in Angland, the cheating little bastard.
But Glockter raised his glass along with everyone else to toast the arrogant ass, while Luther sat there loving every instant of it.
And to think, I sat in that very chair, being applauded and envied and clapped on the back after I won the contest. Different men in the big clothes, different faces, sweating in the heat. But nothing very much has changed. Was my grin really any less smug? Of course not. If anything, I was worse. But at least I earned it.
Such was Lord Hoff's commitment that he did not stop toasting until his goblet was entirely empty. Then he shoved it back on the table and licked his lips.
And now, before the food arrives, a small surprise has been prepared by my colleague Archlector Salt in honor of another of our guests. I hope you will all find it diverting.
And the Lord Chamberlain sat heavily back down, holding his empty goblet out for more wine. Glockter glanced across at Salt.
A surprise from the Archlector? Bad news for somebody.
The heavy red curtains of the stage rolled slowly back. They revealed an old man lying on the boards, his white garment daubed with colourful blood. A broad canvas behind depicted a forest scene beneath a starry sky. It reminded Glockter rather unpleasantly of the mural in the round room, the room beneath Severard's crumbling pile by the docks. A second old man swept on from the wings. A tall, slender man with remarkably fine, sharp features. His head was shaved bald, and he had grown a short white beard, but Glockter recognized him immediately.
Josef Lestek, one of the city's most respected actors.
He gave a mannered start as he noticed the bloody corpse.
Whoa!
He wailed, spreading his arms wide in an actor's approximation of shock and despair. It was a truly enormous voice, loud enough to make the rafters shake. Confident that he had the undivided attention of the chamber, Lestek began to intone his lines,
hands sweeping through the air, towering passions sweeping across his face.
"So here at last my master Juvens lies, and with his death all hope of peace now dies. By Canadius's treachery undone, his passing is the setting of the sun upon an age."
The old actor threw back his head, and Gloctor saw tears sparkling in his eyes. A neat trick to cry on demand like that. A lonely drop trickled slowly down his cheek, and the audience sat spellbound. He turned once again to the body.
"Here, brother murders brother! All slow time can never have recorded such a crime. I half expect to see the stars go out. Why does the ground not open up and spout some raging flame?"
He threw himself down on his knees and beat upon his aging breast.
"Oh, bitter fate! I would most happily now join my master, but it cannot be. For when a great man dies, we that remain, though in a narrowed world, must brave the pain and struggle onward."
Estek looked slowly up towards the audience, slowly clambered to his feet, his expression shifting from deepest sorrow to grimmest determination.
"For though the Maker's house is locked and barred, all carved from rock and steel, all wondrous hard, if I must wait until that steel is rust, or with my bare hands crush that rock to dust, I'll have my vengeance!"
The actor's eyes flashed fire as he flicked out his robe and strode from the stage to rapturous applause. It was a condensed version of a familiar piece often performed, although rarely so well. Gloctor was surprised to find himself clapping. Quite the performance so far. Nobility, passion, command. A great deal more convincing than another fake Byers I could mention. He sat back in his chair, easing his left leg out under the table, and prepared to enjoy the show. Logan watched with his face screwed up in confusion. He guessed that this was one of the spectacles that Byers had spoken of, but his grip on the language wasn't good enough to catch the details. They swept up and down the stage with much sighing and waving of their hands, dressed in bright costumes and speaking in some kind of chant. Two of them were supposed to be dark-skinned, he thought, but were clearly pale men with black paint on their faces. In another scene, the one playing Byers whispered to a woman through a door, seeming to plead with her to open it. Only the door was a piece of painted wood, stood up on its own in the middle of the stage, and the woman was a boy in a dress. It would have been easier, Logan thought, to step around the piece of wood and speak to him or her directly. Logan was sure of one thing, though. The real Byers was seriously displeased. He could feel his annoyance mounting with each scene. It reached a teeth-grinding peak when the villain of the piece, a big man with a glove and an eye patch, pushed the boy in the dress over some wooden battlements. It was plain that he or she was meant to have fallen a great distance, even though Logan could hear him hit something soft just behind the stage.
"How fucking dare they?"
the real Byers growled under his breath. Logan would have got all the way out of the room if he could have, but he had to be content with shuffling his chair towards West, as far from the Magus's fury as possible. On the stage, the other Byers was battling the old man with the glove and the eye patch, although they fought by walking round in circles and talking a lot. Finally, the villain followed the boy off the back of the stage, but not before his adversary took an enormous golden key from him.
"There's more detail here than in the original," muttered the real Byers as his counterpart held up the key and spouted some more verse.
Logan was little further on when the performance came to a close, but he caught the last two lines just before the old actor bowed low.
"Pray your indulgence at our story's end.
Our humble purpose was not to offend.
My fucking old ass it wasn't, hissed Baez through gritted teeth, while fixing a grin and clapping enthusiastically.
Glockter watched Lestek take a few last bows as the curtains closed on him, the golden key still shining in his hand. Archlector Salt rose from his chair as the applause died.
"I am so glad you enjoyed our little diversion," he said, smiling smoothly round at the appreciative gathering. "I do not doubt that many of you have seen this piece before, but it has a special significance this evening. Captain Luthar is not the only celebrated figure in our midst. There is a second guest of honor here tonight, none other than the subject of our play, Baez himself, the first of the Magi."
Salt smiled and held out his arm towards the old fake on the other side of the room. There was a gentle rustling as every guest turned from the Archlector to look at him. Baez smiled back.
"Good evening," he said.
A few of the worthies laughed, suspecting some further little game, perhaps, but Salt did not laugh with them, and their merriment was short-lived. An uneasy silence descended on the hall. A deadly silence, perhaps.
"The first of the Magi. He has been with us in the Agriont now for several weeks. He and a few companions."
Salt glanced down his nose at the scarred Northman, and then back to the self-styled Magus.
"Baez."
He rolled the word around his mouth, allowing it to sink into his listener's ears.
"The first letter in the alphabet of the old tongue. First apprentice of Juvens. First letter of the alphabet. Is that not so, Master Baez?"
"Why, Archlector," asked the old man, still smirking, "have you been checking up on me?"
Impressive. Even now, when he must sense the game will soon be over, he sticks to his role. Salt was unmoved, however.
"It is my duty thoroughly to investigate anyone who might pose a threat to my king or country," he intoned stiffly.
"How fearsomely patriotic of you. Your investigations no doubt revealed that I am still a member of the Closed Council, even if my chair stands empty for the time being. I believe Lord Baez would be the proper term of address."
Salt's cold smile did not slip even a hair's breadth.
"And when exactly was your last visit, Lord Baez? It would seem that someone so deeply involved in our history would have taken more of an interest over the years. Why, if I may ask, in the centuries since the birth of the Union, since the time of Harold the Great, have you not been back to visit us?"
"A good question. I wish it had occurred to me."
"Oh, but I have been. During the reign of King Morlick the Mad, and in the civil war which followed, I was tutor to a young man called Arnold. Later, when Morlick was murdered and Arnold was raised to the throne by the Open Council, I served as his Lord Chamberlain. I called myself Bieleveld in those days. I visited again in King Casimir's reign. He called me Zola. And I had your job, Archlector."
Glockter could barely contain a gasp of indignation and heard others from the chairs around him.
"He has no shame, I'll give him that. Bieleveld and Zola, two of the Union's most respected servants. How dare he? And yet..."
He pictured the painting of Zola in the Archlector's study and the statue of Bieleveld in the Kingsway. Both bald, both stern, both bearded. But what am I thinking? Major West is thinning out on top. Does that make him a legendary wizard? Most likely this charlatan merely picked the two baldest figures he could find.
Salt, meanwhile, was trying a different tack.
"Tell me this, then, Baez. It is a story well known that Harrod himself doubted you when you first came to his hall all those long years ago. As proof of your power, you broke his long table in two. It may be that there are some skeptics among us here tonight, Would you consider such a demonstration for us now?
The colder Salt's tone became, the less the old fraud seemed to care. He dismissed this latest effort with a lazy wave of his hand.
What you speak of is not juggling, Archlector, or playing on the stage. There are always dangers and costs. Besides, it would be a great shame to spoil Captain Luthar's feast simply so I could show off, don't you think? Not to mention the waste of a fine old piece of furniture. I, unlike so many others these days, have a healthy respect for the past.
Some were smiling uncertainly as they watched the two old men fencing with each other, perhaps still suspecting an elaborate joke. Others knew better and were frowning hard, trying to work out what was going on and who had the upper hand. High Justice Morovia, Glockta noticed, looked to be thoroughly enjoying himself.
Almost as if he knows something we don't.
Glockta shifted uncomfortably in his chair, eyes fixed on the bald actor.
Things are not going as well as they should be. When will he begin to sweat? When?
Someone placed a bowl of steaming soup in front of Logan. No doubt it was meant to be eaten, but now his appetite was gone. Logan might be no courtier, but he could spot folk working up to violence when he saw them. With each exchange between the two old men, their smiles slipped further. Their voices became harder. The hall seemed to grow closer and more oppressive. Everyone in the room was looking worried now. West, the proud lad who'd won that sword game because of Byers's cheating, the feverish cripple who'd asked all the questions. Logan felt the hairs on his neck rising. There were two figures lurking in the nearest doorway. Black-clothed figures, black-masked. His eyes flicked across to the other entrances. Each held two of those masked figures, two at least, and he didn't reckon they were here to collect the plates. They were here for him. For him and Byers, he could feel it. A man doesn't put on a mask unless he's got some dark work in mind. There was no way that he could deal with half that many, but he slid a knife from beside his plate and hid it behind his arm anyway. If they tried to take him, he'd fight. That didn't need thinking about. Byers was starting to sound angry.
I have supplied you with all the proofs you've asked for, Archlector.
Proofs?
The tall man they called Salt gave a cold sneer.
You deal in words and dusty papers. More the business of a sniveling clerk than the stuff of legend. Some would say that a magus without magic is simply a meddling old man. We are at war and can take no chances. You mentioned Archlector Zoller. His diligence in the cause of truth is well documented. You, I am sure, must understand mine.
He leaned forward, planting his fists firmly on the table before him.
Show us magic, Byers! Or show us the key!
Logan swallowed. He didn't like the way that things were going, but then he didn't understand the rules of this game. He had put his trust in Byers, for some reason, and there it would have to stay. It was a little late to be changing sides.
Have you nothing left to say?
Demanded Salt. He slowly lowered himself into his chair, smiling once more. His eyes slid over to the archways, and Logan felt the masked figures moving forward, straining to be released.
Have you no more words? Have you no more tricks?
Only one?
Byers reached into his collar. He took hold of something there and drew it out, a long, thin chain. One of the black-masked figures stepped forward a pace, expecting a weapon, and Logan's hand gripped tighter on the handle of the knife. But when the chain came all the way out, there was only a rod of dark metal dangling on the end of it.
The key,
said Byers, holding it up to the candlelight. It barely shone at all.
Less luster than the one in your play, perhaps, but the real thing, I assure you. Canadius never worked with gold. He did not like pretty things. He liked things that worked.
The Archlector's lip curled.
Do you simply expect us to take your word for it?
Of course not.
It is your job to be suspicious of everyone, and I must say you do it exceptionally well. It does grow rather late, however, so I will wait until tomorrow morning to open the House of the Maker. Someone dropped a spoon on the floor, and it clattered against the tiles. There will need to be some witnesses present, of course, to make sure that I don't try any sleight of hand. How about... Byers's cool green eyes swept down the table. Inquisitor Glockter and your new fencing champion, Captain Luther? The cripple frowned as he was named. Luther looked utterly bewildered. The Archlector sat, his scorn swapped for a stony blankness. He gazed from Byers's smiling face to that gently swinging rod of dark metal, then back again. His eyes moved over to one of the doorways, and he gave a tiny shake of his head. The dark figures faded back into the shadows. Logan unclenched his aching teeth, then quietly slipped the knife back onto the table. Byers grinned.
"Dear me, Master Salt, you really are a hard man to please."
"I believe your eminence is the proper term of address," hissed the Archlector.
"So it is, so it is. I do declare you really won't be happy until I've broken some furniture. I would hate to spill everyone's soup, though, so..."
With a sudden bang, the Archlector's chair collapsed. His hand shot out and grabbed at the tablecloth as he plunged to the floor in a clattering mess of loose firewood and sprawled in the wreckage with a groan. The king started awake. His guests blinked and gasped and stared. Byers ignored them.
"This really is an excellent soup," he said, slurping noisily from his spoon.
Chapter 38 The House of the Maker. It was a stormy day, and the House of the Maker stood stark and grim, a huge dark shape against the ragged clouds. A cold wind whipped between the buildings and through the squares of the Agriont, making the tails of Glockter's black coat flap around him as he shuffled after Captain Luthar and the would-be Magus, the scarred Northman at his side. He knew they were watched.
Watched the whole way, behind the windows, in the doorways, on the roofs.
The practicals were everywhere. He could feel their eyes. Glockter had half expected, half hoped, that Byers and his companions would have disappeared in the night. But they had not. The bald old man seemed as relaxed as if he had undertaken to open a fruit cellar, and Glockter did not like it.
"When does the bluff end? When does he throw his hands up and admit it's all a game? When we reach the university? When we cross the bridge? When we stand before the very gate of the Maker's house and his key does not fit?"
But somewhere in the back of his mind the thought lurked.
What if it does not end? What if the door opens? What if he truly is as he claims to be?
Byers chattered to Luthar as they strolled across the empty courtyard towards the university.
"Every bit as much at ease as a grandfather with his favorite grandson, and every bit as boring.
Of course, the city is so much larger than when I last visited. That district you call the Three Farms, all teeming bustle and activity. I remember when that whole borough was Three Farms, indeed I do, and far beyond the city walls."
Said Luthar.
"And as for the Spicer's new guild hall, I never saw such ostentation."
Glockter's mind raced as he limped after the two of them, trawling for hidden meanings in the sea of blather, grasping for order in the chaos. The questions tumbled over each other.
Why pick me as a witness? Why not the Archlector himself? Does this Byers suppose that I can be easily fooled? And why Luthar? Because he won the contest? And how did he win? Is he a part of this deception?
But if Luthar was party to some sinister plan, he was giving no sign. Glockter had never seen the slightest hint that he was anything other than the self-obsessed young fool he appeared to be.
"And then we come to this puzzle."
Glockter glanced sidelong at the big Northman.
There were no signs of deadly intent on his scarred face, little sign that anything was going on in there at all.
Is he very stupid or very clever? Is he to be ignored or feared? Is he the servant or the master?
There were no answers to any of it, yet.
"Well, this place is a shadow of its former self," said Baez as they halted outside the door of the university, raising an eyebrow at the grimy, tilting statues.
He rapped briskly on the weathered wood, and the door swayed on its hinges. To Glockta's surprise, it opened almost immediately.
"You're expected,"
croaked the ancient porter. They stepped around him into the gloom.
"I will show you to—"
began the old man as he wrestled the creaking door shut.
"No need,"
called Baez over his shoulder, already striding briskly off down the dusty corridor.
"I know the way."
Glockta struggled to keep up, sweating despite the cold weather, leg burning all the way. The effort of maintaining the pace scarcely gave him time to consider how the bald bastard might be so familiar with the building.
But familiar he certainly is.
He swept down the corridors as though he had spent every day of his life there, clicking his tongue in disgust at the state of the place, and prattling all the while.
"I've never seen such dust, eh, Captain Luther? I wouldn't be surprised if the damn place hadn't been cleaned since I was last here. I've no idea how a man can think under such conditions. No idea at all."
Centuries of dead and justly forgotten adepti stared gloomily down from their canvases, as though upset by all the noise. The corridors of the university rolled past, an ancient, dusty, forsaken-seeming place, with nothing in it but grimy old paintings and musty old books. Giselle had precious little use for books. He had read a few about fencing and riding, a couple about famous military campaigns, once opened the covers on a great big history of the Union he found in his father's study, and got bored after 3 or 4 pages. Baez droned on.
"Here we fought with the Maker's servants. I remember it well. They cried out to Canadius to save them, but he would not come down. These halls ran with blood, rang with screams, rolled with smoke that day."
Giselle had no idea why the old fool would single him out to tell his tall stories to, and still less how to reply.
"That sounds violent."
Baez nodded.
"It was. I am not proud of it, but good men must sometimes do violent things."
"Huh?" said the Northman suddenly. Giselle had not been aware that he was even listening.
"Besides, that was a different age, a violent age. Only in the old empire were people advanced beyond the primitive. Middleland, the heart of the Union, believe it or not, was a sty, a wasteland of warring, barbaric tribes. The luckiest among them were taken into the Maker's service. The rest were painted-faced savages, without writing, without science, with barely anything to separate them from the beasts."
Giselle glanced furtively up at Nine Fingers. It was not at all difficult to picture a barbaric state with that big brute beside him. But it was ridiculous to suppose that his beautiful home had once been a wasteland, that he was descended from primitives. This bald old man was a blathering liar, or a madman. But some important people seemed to take him seriously. And Giselle thought it best always to do what the important people said. Logan followed the others into a broken-down courtyard, bounded on 3 sides by the crumbling buildings of the university, on the 4th by the inner face of the sheer wall of the Agriant. All was covered in old moss, thick ivy, dry brambles. A man sat on a rickety chair among the weeds, watching them come closer.
"I've been expecting you," he said,
pushing himself up with some difficulty.
"Damn knees! I'm not what I used to be."
An unremarkable man past middle age, in a threadbare shirt with stains down the front. Baez frowned at him.
"You are the chief warden?"
"I am."
"And where are the rest of your company?"
"My wife is getting the breakfast ready, but not counting her. Well, I am the whole company. It's eggs, he said happily, patting his stomach.
What?
For breakfast. I like eggs.
Good for you, muttered Baez, looking slightly put out.
In King Casimir's reign, the bravest 50 men of the king's own were appointed wardens of the house to guard this gate. There was considered to be no higher honour.
That was a long time ago,
said the one and only warden, plucking at his dirty shirt.
There were 9 of us when I was a lad, but they went on to other things, or died, and were never replaced. Don't know who'd take over when I'm gone. There haven't been too many applicants.
You surprise me.
Baez cleared his throat.
Oh, Chief Warden, I, Baez, first of the Magi, seek your leave to pass up the stair to the 5th gate, beyond the 5th gate and on to the bridge, across the bridge, and to the door of the Maker's House.
The Chief Warden squinted back.
You sure?
Baez was growing impatient.
Yes, why?
I remember the last fellow who tried it, way back when I was a lad. Some big man, I reckon, some thinker. He went up those steps with 10 strong workmen, chisels and hammers and picks and what have you, telling us how he was going to open up the house, bring out its treasures and all. 5 minutes and they were back, saying nothing, looking like they saw the dead walk.
What happened? Murmured Luther.
Don't know, but they had no treasures with them, I can tell you that.
Without doubt, a daunting story, said Baez. But we're going.
Your business, I suppose.
And the old man turned and slouched across the miserable courtyard. Up a narrow stair they went, the steps worn down in the middle, up to a tunnel through the high wall of the Agriont, onto a narrow gate in the darkness. Logan felt an odd sense of worry as the bolt slid back. He shrugged his shoulders, trying to get rid of it, and the warden grinned at him.
You can feel it already, eh?
Feel what?
The Maker's Breath, they call it.
He gave the doors the gentlest shove. They swung open together, light spilling through into the darkness.
The Maker's Breath!
Glockter tottered across the bridge, teeth clenched tight on gums, painfully aware of the volume of empty air beneath his feet. It was a single, delicate arch, leaping from high up on the wall of the Agriont to the gate of the Maker's House. He had often admired it from down in the city, on the other side of the lake, wondering how it had stayed up all these years. A spectacular, remarkable, beautiful thing.
It does not seem so beautiful now.
Not much wider than a man lying down, too narrow by far for comfort, and with a terrifying drop to the water below. Worse still, it had no parapet, not so much as a wooden handrail.
And the breeze is rather fresh today.
Luthar and Ninefingers seemed worried enough by it,
and they have the free and painless use of both their legs.
Only Baez made the long trip across without apparent worry, as confident as if his feet were on a country lane. They walked always in the vast shadow of the House of the Maker, of course. The closer they came, the more massive it seemed, its lowest parapet far higher than the wall of the Agriont. A stark black mountain, rising sheer from the lake below, blotting out the sun. A thing from a different age, built on a different scale. Glockter glanced back towards the gate behind him. Did he catch a glimpse of something between the battlements on the wall above? A practical watching? They would see the old man fail to open the door. They would be waiting to take him on their way back through.
But until then, I am helpless.
It was not a comforting thought, and Glockter was in need of comfort. As he tottered further across the bridge, a niggling fear swelled inside him. It was more than the height, more than the strange company, more than the great tower looming above. A base fear without reason. The animal terror of a nightmare. With every shuffling step, the feeling grew. He could see the door now, a square of dark metal set back into the smooth stones of the tower. A circle of letters was etched into the center of it. For some reason, they made Glockter want to vomit, but he dragged himself closer. Two circles,
large letters and small letters, a spidery script he did not recognize. His guts churned. Many circles, letters and lines too detailed to take in. They swam before his stinging